Hello and welcome to Radio Retail with me, your host, William Madison. And we're back. After a few weeks off, we've got a triple hitter of interviews for you. Later in the episode, we'll be talking BRC meetings with government ministers around post-Brexit alignment with the EU on product safety. We'll also be talking about how to empower local teams to improve marketing and be more relevant to their communities. But first, everyone is talking about it. So in my conversation with Natalie Berg and Javier Dillon, we talk about the cost of living crisis and what consumer trends we're starting to see already. This interview was recorded on the 27th of May, and we hope you enjoy the discussion. And I'm joined now by Javier Dillon, economist here at the BRC, and by Natalie Berg, retail analyst, founder of NBK Retail, and friend of the BRC. Javier, Natalie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So guys, we're going to start off, Javier, maybe we can start with you. A lot of the headlines at the moment are centered around the cost of living crisis. We've seen a lot of announcements recently about the fallout from energy prices increasing again, and a potential windfall tax. And what are we expecting in the short term to see in terms of consumer prices as a result of all of this? And maybe further to that, how long are we expecting these conditions to last?
Well, if I start off with inflationary pressures, the Bank of England sees it topping off at 10.2% by the end of the year, which might be a sort of slight underestimate at this point, given where inflationary pressures are heading. Now, with the cost of living announcement that came yesterday, it was quite a significant package. We saw about 15 billion or so of fiscal transfers, £400 to every household, and considerably more if you're in, I suppose, a vulnerable or lower income household. And there's quite a considerable amount of debate over whether these fiscal measures will in itself generate more inflation, as perhaps we may have seen in the States with kind of direct check payments to individuals. What it does make more likely or more certain, however, are further interest rate hikes from the Bank of England. And interest rate hikes are typically associated with a stronger pound, and a stronger pound is typically associated with cheaper imports. Our kind of spending power goes up for buying goods from overseas. So whether there's a positive impact on inflation or a kind of neutral impact, I suppose, remains to be seen. However, what we can say in the near term is that those inflationary pressures are going to remain, and they are going to ramp up considerably, particularly when we're talking about something like food.
Natalie, coming to you now, it feels like, well, it's a little bit of crisis after crisis at the moment for retailers. We obviously had incredibly tough conditions during the pandemic, and now we're facing historic inflation. There's been a lot of talk, there was a lot of talk about the so-called new normal, but this level of disruption now seems like it's becoming a pretty regular thing. Is this something that retailers are now just going to have to adapt to and get used to? Or, you know, is this maybe hopefully slightly more short-term?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think some of the disruption we're seeing is inherently more short term, but it does feel like we are in a perpetual state of disruption. As you say, we've gone from one crisis to another. And from a consumer's perspective, it's made us pretty resilient. We've learned to adapt our behaviors, whether that's because the cost of fuel has gone up or because we're in a pandemic and we're all shopping online. So I think as consumers, we've learned to be pretty agile and pretty resilient. And the same goes for retailers too. I think when we think about disruption, not all disruption is bad. I think that's an important point. And it comes in many forms. So we've had technology disruption. We've had this whole digital disruption, which has forced high street retailers to reinvent their physical stores, to invest in digital, and that's e-commerce, but it's also a technology in store. And so there's been this whole acceleration in digital transformation that's been spurred on by the pandemic. Because I think when the pandemic hit, it really just accelerated a lot of those trends that had already been brewing, really upended shopping habits, transformed our lives, and propelled us towards this more digital world. We also have had disruption in the form of Brexit. COVID is still causing disruption to supply chains. You know, we think COVID is over, but if you speak to retailers, what's really concerning them It's less about, well, the cost of living crisis is clearly a huge concern, but it's also about the challenges in sourcing. And I think that's going to be a particular challenge in the second half of the year as we move into this critical trading period for retailers. But clearly, as Javier mentioned, the cost of living crisis is the number one concern for everyone right now. And also, we've got a fair amount of geopolitical instability in the mix as well. So it is a challenging time for retail.
Javier, these types of squeezes on consumer wallets obviously going to result in some changes in spending trends. Are we seeing any of those changes already? What kinds of consumer trends are we already noticing?
If we're looking at kind of the major consumer sentiment indices, one trend that's immediately apparent is much less confidence about committing to big ticket spending, those big ticket items, and a general shift away from discretionary spending towards essential spending that is now taking up a considerable amount of those wallets just because of inflationary pressures in a place like fuel, for example. People are questioning, do I need to drive as much as I used to? And various other things that are going on in the mix. But certainly that kind of theme of discretionary spending being under quite a squeeze and shifting towards essential spending is a trend that we are seeing.
And Natalie, I just want to pick up on... Oh, sorry, do you want to jump in there?
I was just going to pick up on Javier's point, because I think what's interesting, you know, we just talked about all the different forms of disruption. And sometimes I think it's hard to unpick what's actually driving what in the industry. And while there, I think it's very clear that the cost of living crisis is impacting households very differently, we also have to acknowledge that there has been a shift back to pre-pandemic lifestyles to a certain extent. So we're going on holidays again, we're spending on leisure and travel. And actually, there is this whole question, is that helping or hindering retail? Clearly, from the retailers that I've spoken to, they're seeing, despite the inflationary pressures on the customer, they are seeing increased demand for things like menswear, dresses, people returning to the office. And so I think there is there's sort of two different, very different forces pulling the consumer at the same time.
There's a lot of talk around, we've got to meet with the consumers at where they are now. You know, it's completely the way that we act as consumers and as retailers has completely changed. You mentioned just before about the sort of convergence of the physical store with the digital space and the digital retailing space becoming a more immersive experience. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how important it is that retailers are sort of embracing technology to achieve these new ways because consumers ultimately want to meet them on different platforms now than they used to?
That's right. It's getting so difficult to meet the customer because, you know, as customers, we expect to shop on our terms, not the terms that the retailer dictates. We want speed, but we also want an experience. And increasingly, what we're seeing is this democratization of white glove service. So increasingly, retailers are having to essentially roll out the red carpet for their customers and surprise and delight them and give them an experience when they come into a physical store, give them an experience that a screen can't. So it's really about this divergence between functional and fun shopping. And that's been brewing for a long time, but we've really seen this shift accelerated by the pandemic. But I think you're absolutely right. We are seeing this convergence between physical and digital. So on the one hand, you have physical retail looking to technology to bring their stores into the 21st century. So physical retail is becoming very digital, very digitized. And then on the other hand, you have digital experiences becoming more immersive, becoming more lifelike. You know, there's a lot of talk about the metaverse, but I think before we even get there, we have it now. We have augmented reality, we have live shopping, we have virtual shopping consultations where increasingly retailers are recognizing the opportunities in connecting their online shoppers with in-store staff. So this convergence is already happening. And I think the message for retailers is that it's not about online or in-store. You really have to know where your customer is. You don't have to be present everywhere and do everything because there's a lot of choice out there. And there's a lot of decisions to be made around technology investment. But you really, it's so important now to know your customer and to make sure that you're meeting them, whether that's in a physical or digital space.
And particularly on this last point, for the listeners, if you're interested in some of these, especially these last couple of topics that we've been talking about today, you might be interested in an upcoming event that we have, the Consumer Insights Forum, on the 15th of June. It'll be a morning of networking and panel discussions featuring many of the leading minds in the industry, including Natalie. And if you want to find out more, you can visit brc.org.uk/events. Other than that, Natalie, Javier, I want to thank you both for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having us. It's been fun.
Thanks to Natalie and Javier for coming on the podcast. And if you are interested in attending the Consumer Insights Forum on the 15th of June, you can find a link in the show notes. Over the past few years, we've seen brands that relate to their local community perform best. But this provides a challenge, especially for multi-site retailers. How do you balance broader branding at a regional, national, or international level with that need to empower local teams to speak directly to their local customers in a way that's truly genuine? I sat down with Claire Bailey and Chris Rose to find out. And I'm joined now by actually a couple of guests. By way of introduction, I'm first joined by Claire Bailey, independent retail expert and the author of The Retail Champion. Claire, how's it going?
Good, thank you, Will.
And we're also joined by Chris Rose, Business Transformation and Implementation Director at Halfords Auto Centres. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Will. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, good. So just jumping into things, today we're going to be talking about what is actually quite a challenging space for a lot of retailers, which sort of revolves around the issue of brand. Claire, to start us off, I wanted to talk about hyperlocal marketing. It's a term that a lot of retailers and listeners are probably aware of, but can you give us an outline of what hyperlocal marketing is and why it's so essential for modern retailers?
Yes, absolutely. So from my perspective, hyperlocal marketing is kind of the panacea for any multiple retail or consumer facing business, because what it enables them to do is take the brand consistency, that of course is something that's so heavily invested in by head office teams, and enables the retail outlets and the restaurants, cafes, bars, shops, whatever it may be in the community to deploy that brand in an appropriate and relevant style to resonate with that local community. And what we've seen coming out of the pandemic, of course, is that people are much more connected to their local community-based retailers, the kind of businesses that they've done their one-hour walk past for so many months, and they've noticed a lot more, and they feel a lot more support for to enable those high street businesses, large and small, to succeed. And I think that what a lot of the larger retailers grapple with is this possibility of cascading brand compliance and brand governance out into the hands of store management in a way that means that they remain on brand and on message, whilst also being able to tailor that messaging to resonate with the local community. And also there's an element of cost saving that comes into hyperlocal marketing as well, of course, because we've seen the cost of obviously fuel and transport going up and every other part of the raw material supply chain. And actually the deployment of things like point of sale material has always been a bit of a one size fits all. There'd be a national package of POS that went out to our stores, probably from a national print provider. And that was something that was just done. And we've seen over the years, lots of wastage in that process, not least in the mileage traveled by each of those posters, but some of those assets never actually make it into the store because they might not have the right display materials or the right window sizing. So hyperlocal marketing isn't just about getting the right messaging, the right seasonality, the right story for perhaps religious groups in an area, weather differences in an area, demographic differences. It's also about being able to produce your point of sale in your community, potentially in your store or with a local print partner, and have something that you know you can be 100% compliant on the deployment of. So zero wastage, much lower carbon footprint, much fewer miles traveled. So for me, hyperlocal marketing is a huge topic for saving money and connecting with local communities.
Chris, coming at it from a Halfords perspective, it's obviously a massive company. So how do you approach that sort of balancing act between being relevant on a local level and keeping up with brand consistency on a national level?
Yeah, thanks, Will. I mean, brand consistency at a national level is the relatively simpler part of the equation because you manage it through guidelines, a variety of tools, you have data, and you understand the best way to execute that. The localized content we generally like to manage in a couple of ways. The first is a level of activity or POS that can be called off locally and used at discretion. And we call that freedom within a framework, is you have the freedom to act upon it, but it sits in a brand consistent framework. That way the colleagues and the customers both get something relevant to their individual needs. We also do this in a second way, where we localize some content centrally. And based on the geography and the feedback locally, we then stream that through media to make it very relevant for the customer. And that could be as simple as what the traffic is doing, or it could be something about the local community and tying products and services in with that message. The consistency part locally, though, I must point out, technology is the enabler to be able to get all of that right. But the engagement of colleagues and the why delivered through the technology is really key to making sure the accuracy is delivered.
So, Chris, as a follow-up there, there's obviously this balance between allowing people at the local level to feel empowered to make the best decisions for the customers in that local area. How important is that to trust those local teams?
You have to trust your colleagues and the local teams to get that right in those local communities. It's an absolutely vital part of great service at any level. And we support our teams to work with customers to get the very best outcome. Will, that could be as simple as managing the customer diaries for the best fit with the best services and the best products. Ensuring the ranges are fit for the location, for example. But a good example of empowering teams locally is where we explore our customer needs. And what we do is we use all the assets in a town to make that happen. So for example, an average Halfords town could have access to a mobile expert. And that is a van that can deliver motoring or bicycle services to your front door or place of work. We also have garages, our motoring services, and we have stores. So when a customer comes in with a need, and that might be to buy a product in a store, and the store also delivers a health check on that vehicle, and the follow-up could be the mobile van then arrives locally to that customer to sort any needs that they do have, and also pick up maybe on an MOT that might be needed in the future. So understanding for every customer what's available locally versus the national proposition is absolutely vital. And we trust our teams on the ground to work within a freedom, but within a framework to offer customers all those local innovative solutions that we provide.
Claire, I know you've worked with a lot of brands across the industry. What are some of the ways that you've seen retailers deal with these problems, maybe for better or for worse? And I guess the extension there is, if you're listening as a retailer, what's a lesson that you could learn to apply to your own business?
Well, it's interesting, actually. I made a couple of notes while you were both speaking. Will, you've mentioned the empowerment of colleagues and the trust. And Chris rightly says a lot of this is tech enabled. One of the businesses I've been working with to support them in their outreach to the UK retail market quite recently is a brand called Paperfly. They've been really successful over the last 15 years with the retailers in the Nordics. Elkjøp, for example, who represent over 50% of the store portfolio of Currys globally. But they just haven't really been around in the UK in any great penetration. But what I've noticed that they are doing for a lot of their customers, and there are other tech providers that do this, is they provide that freedom within a framework. Templated marketing assets, which are locked down to store level that they can edit certain things and not. So the store managers know they can't go wrong, because a lot of the times that people won't act on ideas is the fear of reprimand, I think, or fear of getting things wrong. But with tools and technology that allow them to do what they can and not what they shouldn't, that really does give them what Chris is saying with that freedom in a framework. And I think that really the keys to success is having the right tools, the right training and education within the store portfolio, and also suitable internal comms to advise people of, you know, it's going to be hot in Devon this week, but it's snowing in Scotland. So you guys roll out your flip-flops and your sunshades, whereas you might want to put out some umbrellas. And it's little things like that that enable the aspect of hyperlocal marketing. But on the other hand, it's also about really getting the feedback from the stores. So I think it's very important to have a two-way communication. And that's something else I've seen really powerful coming through from a number of different brands. They are doing activities with their retail partners and with their dealerships that allow their store management, their coal face, to feed back up to brand marketing teams to say, you know, we could do with doing something for an event, a calendar activity, a sporting event, depending on their locality. And that then informs the brand and marketing teams of to what kind of collateral could be distributed down to those stores so that they can act on the opportunity to really catch the eye and catch the attention of the passerby. I think we all know that footfall has been very challenged post-pandemic, and we're just seeing the results coming through from the various providers of the data, obviously BRC being one in particular, saying that footfall's just about up to pre-pandemic level, but we're not necessarily seeing those people who are passing the stores crossing the threshold. So really super engaging and relevant marketing is fundamental to getting the shopper passing by to cross your threshold to become a browser. And then within the store environment, POS that catches their attention and makes them make the purchase, turning that browser into a customer. And as Chris picks up on as well, there is a lot of activity of cross-pollination between the different brands and the different outlets within a community. And I know from chatting to Chris, you know, Halfords have got all these different opportunities within a locality. I would not necessarily know if I walked into a store. So it comes back to that empowerment of the local teams to have the assets, the collateral and the information to share that with the customers. And not just in traditional means either. It's not just print. It can be email marketing, digital marketing, social media and so on. So I think that the whole story around communicating with the customer in a multi-channel marketing way that also is made relevant to the local community and to the needs and wants of the community has significant benefits. And that's where I think technology does enable the empowerment, which of course leads to greater staff loyalty and they feel valued. You then have the freedom within the framework, so you can drive community relevant content appropriate to seasonality, demographic and so on, and you can strip out a huge amount of cost. And that's why I think that this is something that every retailer, large and small, franchise operations, wholly owned, consumer-facing, fast food, restaurant, retail, traditional shops should all be looking at the current time.
Yeah, it's really interesting that point that you make there about sort of communication both up and down the sort of traditional chain of command, I suppose you could call it. It's something that comes up in a lot of our discussions here on the podcast. It's interesting, you know, how often those up the top need to be listening to what's happening on the ground, because you know, there's so much vital information, both up the top and down the bottom that that everyone could be learning from. I think, guys, that's where we're going to leave the discussion for today. But there's some really interesting stuff in there for listeners to dig their teeth into. Claire, Chris, I want to thank you both for coming on Radio Retail.
Thank you very much, Will. Lovely to have a chat with you. And thank you, Chris, as well.
Yeah, thank you, Will. Thank you, Claire. It's been a pleasure.
My thanks to Claire and Chris for coming on the podcast. For our final conversation today, I speak to Adrian Simpson about the divergence we're seeing on product safety between the UK and the EU post-Brexit. We also talk about how retailers are coping and the impending regulation changes you might need to know about. This interview was recorded on the 17th of May, and we hope you enjoy the discussion. And I'm joined now by Adrian Simpson, Retail Products Advisor here at the BRC. Adrian, how's it going?
Yeah, not too bad, William. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on again.
It's good to have you back. Now, Adrian, this is the second time you've been on the podcast. For those that missed the first episode, you head up our buying community. Can you give us a quick overview of what the work of the buying community is all about?
Sure. The buying community exists, William, to help retailers sell safe and compliant products. So we hold a number of working groups, we hold regular meetings, and we actually work together to try and resolve some common product safety issues.
And that question of product safety here is what we're talking about today. Now, I know yesterday you had a meeting with a pretty senior government minister on product safety, I just want to ask a little bit about what the discussions were, and also, I guess, more broadly, what some of the issues that we're seeing in the product safety space at the moment.
Well, post-Brexit, product safety has undergone a little bit of review. Currently, the Office of Product Safety and Standards are running a product safety review. And probably more interestingly for retailers is that from the 1st of 2023, products placed on the market in Great Britain will need a UKCA compliance mark. Now, all over your house, I'm sure you've got products that have got the CE mark, and the CE mark has been around since about the mid-90s, and people aren't actually sure what it means. I mean, do you have any idea what it means, William?
Absolutely no clue.
Okay. People sometimes think it means something to do like with either Chinese exports or Central Europe or something like that. What it actually is, it's a manufacturer's declaration that the goods conform to all the relevant health, safety and environmental requirements. It's a bit of a long-winded thing, but it doesn't actually necessarily guarantee that the product is safe. I'm not sure anyone could 100% guarantee that no product will ever cause any kind of injury or anything like that. So there are a few parties out there who do say that the CE mark means that, you know, it's a guarantee that a product is safe and that consumers should look for it as a guarantee of safety. I'm personally not entirely convinced that is the case, I say, because, you know, we do hear of products, unfortunately, causing injury, even if they have got the CE mark on there. So from the 1st of 2023, you'll be noticing a UKCA mark on many of the products that previously had it. So that's things like chargers, televisions, radio equipment, toys as well. A lot of retailers, manufacturers got ahead of the game and have been using it for quite some time as well. So we were very lucky to be able to get a meeting with the Minister for Brexit Opportunities and Government Efficiency, I think it's titled, which is Jacob Rees-Mogg MP. So we actually met with him last night at the Cabinet Office. So that meeting was there really to give the retail perspective on product compliance and some of the challenges that retailers experience when having to deal with goods that have this mark. Because some of them, of course, are manufacturers. But the CE mark and UKCA mark is the manufacturer's declaration. So some of our retailers are our own branders, which makes them manufacturers. So we're hearing quite a lot around retailers experiencing sort of supply chain friction, I think is what you call it, which in layman's terms is they're experiencing difficulties placing products in the market, say in places like Northern Ireland, where Northern Ireland is for product safety rules and regulations effectively the European Union, which means they've got to place a CE mark on there. But those goods are often also on the UK market, which means UKCA marking, which means sort of double testing for manufacturers. So we just had that very unique opportunity there really to tell the minister, you know, some of the issues we're facing and sort of get our points across from the retail perspective.
For people that don't really have a huge amount of experience in the issue, myself included, I guess the question there is all about alignment, isn't it? So that we have the same standards on the UK side that the EU does. Now, previously, I assume when we were part of the EU, we were part of the same product safety standards. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. So the United Kingdom was aligned, as you say, yeah, with the same standards as with Europe. But now, but post-Brexit, obviously, we have this opportunity, perhaps you want to call it that, to engage in a little bit of a divergence. So that's where the standards in UK or Great Britain can differ from the European Union. And that, of course, will bring a number of considerable challenges as well, where retailers and manufacturers will be placing goods that, you know, in the Great British market that may or may not be of a higher safety standard than Europe, which technically can cause, as you can imagine, all sorts of problems. Because some of these divergence changes can be very, very minor, but can result in obviously quite a lot of costs. I should say, of course, William, that our retailers are obviously very passionate about selling safe and compliant goods. We don't want to see a free-for-all where goods are sold without any kind of product safety standards, where they aren't, you know, goods aren't accountable. I think that would be, you know, that would be going against obviously the sort of 40 or 50 years of considerable product safety that we bought. And I think, you know, the good thing is that British consumers can generally purchase goods without any fear that it's going to electrocute them, poison them, or cause them any kind of injury. And it'd be, obviously, I don't think anyone really wants to go back to the dark old days where no one really had that protection.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll move on now to a couple of subjects which sort of highlight that, I guess, which PFAS. Am I pronouncing that right? PFAS?
That's how we pronounce it. There are, I think, various other pronunciations, but we start with PFAS. Yes, right, PFAS. Right.
So these have been coming up on the media quite a lot at the moment. Maybe it'd be useful if you could just describe first off what they are and how they're currently used.
Yeah, so PFAS are a group of around, I think, 4,700 chemicals that are used in many everyday applications. So things like stain repellency, oil repellency, water repellent products. So they're all over the place. The issues are that these chemicals, they're known as forever chemicals because they take a considerable length of time to break down. They are also believed to be linked to cancer, so some consider them a carcinogen. So a few things to be worried about. So we, the BRC, we're trying to support retailers into considering alternatives because a couple of reasons why. Some of them obviously want to go ahead and do that. But we're also noticing across the world regulatory changes. So for example, in the US, there are some states that are looking to ban it or have put certainly along the lines of banning it. We're seeing it across Europe as well. So for retailers, now is a very good time to sort of look through your supply chain, understand where you've got any of these kind of PFAS products, and perhaps can consider alternatives if you think that's necessary, and certainly get involved with us in the buying community. We've done a lot of work on it. Last week, we held an international summit. So we had international speakers from the United States, from the EU, from the UK. So some of the UK government there as well, talking about the regulatory changes that are coming up. And we had almost, I think, around 100 delegates there from all across our British Retail Consulting Buying Community membership as well. So there's certainly a lot of interest in there for members, and which isn't surprising given the upcoming regulatory changes. So definitely do go through your supply chain and get involved with us, join our community, and certainly join our household goods group, which just focuses on chemicals, cosmetics and cleaning products.
And so you mentioned that there was upcoming regulatory changes globally. Do you think that there are, is there an expectation that could be happening also here in the UK?
Absolutely. I think later this year, I think the GB government will certainly be updating us on their views around regulation of PFAS as well. So absolutely, we know that officials from DEFRA and the Health and Safety Executive are currently reviewing this area.
Interesting. Okay. So finally, we're going to talk a little bit about button batteries. Last time we were on the show, we had a good chat about these. Listeners might know them as the tiny little batteries, the circular little things. Well, I mean, they look like buttons, don't they? That are often in electronics. Last time you were on, we had a chat about some of the dangers that they're causing, particularly for small children, and why it's important for retailers to be aware of some of those dangers and to make changes accordingly. I hear we've had some developments in the space. What can you tell us about that?
So the BRC are actually chairing a workstream on industry standards and best practice as part of a Office of Product and Safety and Standards Working Group on button batteries. I mean, we're looking to obviously address the issue of button batteries, which is that these things can be swallowed by children very easily. They are all around the home. A bit like CE marking, they're everywhere. They're in watches, they're in remote batteries, they're in portable lights. They're all over the place, so children can quite easily access them, and we want to obviously reduce the amount of deaths and injuries that are caused by them, because these are pretty lethal things. If a child swallows them, they can cause all sorts of they can lead to death, and unfortunately there have been quite a few child deaths caused by them. So what we're looking to do really in this particular work stream is to understand what more can be done really by industry and business to reduce button battery deaths and injuries. As I spoke about last time, there is a what's called a PAS, which is a publicly available specification, which is really a best practice guide, if you will, that gives manufacturers and retailers practical advice on what they can do to make button battery products safer, what sort of warnings, etc., are needed. And we do know that a lot of retailers are already using it, but there are a lot of retailers and manufacturers who perhaps aren't that aware of this particular PAS. We're looking to raise awareness of that. So it's not just actually going to be the British Retail Consortium involved in this, where the BRC are leading on this part, but we're looking to engage with many other industry bodies. We would like to especially speak to other trade associations as well, We'd like to be some of the smaller businesses, because obviously the smaller businesses are unlikely to be members of the BRC and have access to our sort of product safety expertise. So we'll be doing a lot of engagement with other bodies as well, just to try and raise awareness of this power, to try and understand why businesses perhaps aren't using this, what are the challenges they face using it as well. So yeah, that's a really exciting bit of work. We're really pleased to have been selected to do that, and we'll be certainly doing a lot more sort of press and publicity on that throughout the year.
I guess it just highlights across the BRC, our policy advisors are engaging with government. And a lot of these things, Adrian, especially the stuff that you're talking about, are sort of, I guess, the technical side of things that people aren't always aware of. And I should say on that note as well, if anybody who's listening is interested in joining the buying community, Adrian, where can they go and what can they do?
Well, on the BRC member section website, you can actually choose which communities you want to be a member of. So make sure you select the buying community. Or if you've got any issues with that, just contact me directly. I'm more than happy to help. I could also add that we do have a household goods group as well. So the household goods groups concentrates on specifically helping retailers around cosmetics, cleaning products and chemicals. The three C's are a challenging area for regulation. And we're also looking to put together a PFAS working group as well, following our summit. So we'll be releasing details of that over the coming weeks. So if you sign up for the buying community, you'll get an email when that group is available and how to join it.
Brilliant. Sounds like very busy times with you, Adrian. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
No problem at all. Thanks, William.
And that about does it for this episode of Radio Retail. I'd like to thank Adrian again and all of our guests for coming on the podcast. If you're enjoying these podcasts, don't forget to rate and subscribe wherever you're listening. If you want to find out more about the work we do here at the BRC, you can visit us at brc.org.uk. If you want to get in touch about future episodes of the show, you can contact me at william.madison@brc.org.uk. Other than that, I want to thank you for joining me on Radio Retail. Goodbye for now.